Good morning. It's Monday. It's 9 a.m. and I'm Tabitha McIntosh talking to you today about what kids should or shouldn't read. Joining me is my friend Ali Mermadi, who will be answering all our burning questions about what fancy people talk to each other at their fancy client meetings. Is it Mozart? Do they have endless chats about Mozart? Let's find out. Dramatic music is back, people. I'm sure you missed it. Right, before we do anything else, it's time for today's education news from Gail Glenn.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News with Gail Glenn. Ofsted have admitted that its inspectors were not highlighting off-rolling when it was identified in schools. Ofsted has told their inspectors that they must use the specific term off-rolling in their report if they find that it is taking place in a school. Ofsted defines off-rolling as the practice of removing a pupil from the school roll without a formal permanent exclusion, or by encouraging a parent to remove their child from the school roll where the removal is primarily in the interests of the school rather than in the interests of the pupil. Off-rolling in these circumstances is a form of gaming. In an update to inspectors, it adds, some schools have issued press releases stating that off-rolling was not found because Ofsted did not use those words. Reports which have already been issued cannot be amended. Ofsted were reported in the Times Educational Supplement to have told inspectors that reports must always use the following set phrase to refer to off-rolling. This practice constitutes off-rolling, according to Ofsted's definition. The Guardian newspaper has reported that a survey of more than 20,000 working parents has found that 96% believe that not enough was being done to support parents with the cost of childcare. One third of parents said they spent less on their rent or mortgage than they did on childcare. 100,000 parents signed a petition asking for an independent review of childcare funding and affordability. This has triggered a debate on childcare in Parliament this week. The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development has released data which puts the UK as the third highest childcare system in the world. A full-time place costs, on average, £12,376 a year. The Department for Education said parents' ability to claim 33 hours a week during term time for 3 and 4 year olds could save them up to £5,000 a year. This has been your daily education news briefing.
One of the sponsors of this show is Oxford University Press. If you need support with your phonics teaching, Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE validated programs to help you. Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sound. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. To find out more about these programs and receive support from your OUP expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. One more time, that's www.oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Right, I know that you've all been anxious for the moment that has now come upon us, which is the opportunity to take notes on likely topics of conversation at imaginary future client meetings with equally imaginary rich people. The inspiration for this came, of course, from Headmistress Catherine Birbalsing, Headmistress of Michaela, currently in the running, I think, for Social Mobility Tsar of Great Britain, because we need more Tsars. That's consistent with leveling up. And she's an enthusiast and an evangelical zealot for the importance of raising expectations, but also boosting cultural capital. I've talked about cultural capital on this program before and how we have a habit of slipping from its original meaning in the works of sociologist Pierre Bourdieu to a rather cultural capitalist shiny coins you can keep in your pocket and dole out at restaurants when needed. And here's how she phrased it. If you don't know who Mozart is, how are you meant to, later on in life, take your rich client out for dinner and hold a culturally literate conversation? So I've asked my friend Ali to join us. A little bit about Ali and I. We met in our very first English literature tutorial at Oxford, where I shone with a deeply feminist reading of Christina Rossetti's Goblin Market, where I managed to use the word patriarchy about 88 times and spell it wrong every single time. And he was nice enough not to mock me for it. I stayed in the more underpaid sectors of the employment world, and he did the banking graduate entry exam. If I sound a bit vague about that, it's because I supported him, but I don't do finance stuff myself. And he became a swaggering master of finance. He, in the kind of, if you've read Liar's Poker, it was that era, coming out of that era. So very exciting, very swaggering. He also had a midlife crisis, my favorite midlife crisis in the history of midlife crises, where he did a master's degree on Joseph Conrad. He reads more than any human I've ever met. He genuinely likes Trollope. Let's find out how much his knowledge of literature and culture has paid off at those fancy restaurant meetings with fancy clients. Ali, if you could call in now, that would be super. Ali, can you hear me?
I can hear. Can you hear me?
I can. You sound malicious and beautiful as ever.
Good morning, Tavi.
Good morning. You have a baby, don't you? How's your baby this morning?
He is on great form and is at nursery at Kingston Hospital, where his mother works. I was reflecting on that fact, listening to the news call about the cost of childcare.
Yeah, did you read the article? It was quite shocking.
It struck me that £12,000 a year is an awful lot of money, and it effectively turns an awful lot of people's jobs into just a way of subsidising their childcare. It does seem slightly counterproductive.
And also sort of existentially pointless in the end. But that's not why I asked you on for reflections on existential crises and childcare. I want to know what rich clients talk about at dinner.
Well, it's a very interesting question, and I've been thinking ever since you prompted me. I've obviously been thinking it through, and I have come up with a little bit of a theory, which I have no doubt you will immediately explode. my theory is that there's a kind of an offensive and defensive side to this cultural capital debate, because to the point, in you know, you and I studied English at university. I think it's not unreasonable to assume that we've probably read more than most people. And have I ever had, in many, many hundreds, if not the early thousands of client meetings, both where I'm the client and I'm the supplier, has there ever been a deep and meaningful conversation about great expectations? And the answer is no. Comparing whatever one might like, you know, the operas of Mozart and Verdi or whatever it might be. The answer is no. On the other hand, the flip side, so I think on the kind of offensive side, does one impress people, make friends and, you know, win friends, influence people by showing a deep knowledge of kind of conventional great culture or whatever phrase mm-hmm. one might use? And the answer is probably no. But the other way around, You know, I think to the quotation that you, I mean, I don't know anything at all about the educator that you mentioned, but to that kind of rather, you know, the kind of soundbite she has about Mozart, mm-hmm. I do think that there are things one's expected to recognise, and not just in kind of high art, but in all kinds of areas, and to not know at all, I think people would be embarrassed, and no one likes that. So I don't think, just based entirely on the soundbite you've read out, I don't think that that's completely unfair. I mean,
your job is to make me feel unreasonable. My job is to just be an arse online. That's kind of what I do. But that's a really interesting point. So the defensive shoring up, the, you know, what every boy should know, all caps kind of letter, that is crucial to some extent, because no one wants to feel embarrassed or taken short. Yeah.
No, and I think there is a weight still to... you know, when we were talking about this yesterday briefly, you know, you were kind of saying, you know, I think for the sake of contrast, you know, is it important to know about Stormzy? Is it important to know about Mozart? Mm-hmm. And the thing is, and it's not, I don't think it's quite the same. I'll give you the example. I know who Stormzy is. I know that he's well regarded. I recognize his photograph. I know that my older kids like his music, and I know that I don't. Mm-hmm. And then one or two more things than that, not much more. But, you know, that's enough. You know, in a room of people talking about Stormzy, I wouldn't embarrass myself. It's not incumbent on me to be a fan. You know, it's kind of, but if I didn't recognize his name, it would be a bit odd, and I'd be a bit excluded, if you know what I mean.
Okay, so this is interesting, because essentially, you know, we're talking about a sort of general knowledge trivia level of culture, both high and low, which I agree, it helps you do things, including crosswords that makes sense.
Well, but I think, and there is, but I think on the, you know, high culture, he's very, I mean, I've often witnessed, you know, I've noticed because, you know, because as you pointed out, you know, if I don't watch myself, I can start expatiating on the glories of Anthony Trollope or Joseph Conrad or whatever it might be. And there's no doubt that most people would be very uncomfortable to admit, for example, they hadn't heard of those people, or they'd be very unlikely to say. In fact, they would definitely never say Trollope's rubbish and I hate Conrad. You know, no one's going to say that. But they're not going to admit to not having heard of them either. If you sort of mean that, not having heard of them would be bad, not criminal. Not having read them is definitely fine.
I like, you know, the idea that there might actually be police outside waiting to swoop in.
I do think, like, if one doesn't, you know, everyone has to kind of doff their cap to, for the sake of argument, Charles Dickens and Mozart and Shakespeare. They don't have to be into it. They don't have to know anything really very much about it. But I think people would feel embarrassed to admit a kind of total ignorance, if you see what I mean. So in other words, I suppose what I've come out at is, you don't need to be kind of aggressively interested, but it's probably bad to not know anything at all. You know, that's where I would come out on it.
I like that a lot. But you also, I actually, what do people literally talk about at dinner? That's another thing.
Well, and people want shared interests. I mean, the example, and forgive me, this is, I don't, you know, waste time on my autobiography, but my parents were and remain extremely enthusiastic golfers. And one of the sadly never to be achieved ambitions of their life was for me to become a good golfer. And I was given an incredibly large number of golf lessons and lots of exposure. Unfortunately, for the benefit of all of your listeners, I will confess live on the radio, I am a spectacularly untalented golfer. I really can't play at all. Now, in my career, the idea always was, if you play golf, it'll be great for business. You'll beat other people that play golf, right?
Right.
In reality, in my business career, I actually very seldom met any golfers. And the two times that I volunteered to play, it was a mistake, because my total incompetence was so great that I would have been better off saying no. as it turned out, golf was not an important part of the cultural, you know, right? On the other hand, there was a long period where I was involved in people who like going shooting, you know, as in driven.
Oh, I remember shooting, that. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And, clay, you know, pigeon shooting and stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing. And so, you know, and I mean, again, to do, you know, what was required? Well, so, you know, if you joining in, people, basically, I think dinner party conversation in business is probably like it is in most areas. People want you to join in with what they're interested in. You don't need to pretend to love it if you hate it, but you probably want to show some level of acknowledgement. And that would be true, of course, if it's football, which of course it very commonly is, mm-hmm. or you know, or game shooting, less common, or golf, in my experience, not very, or Stormzy. I mean, after all, if someone half my age wants to talk about Stormzy, and I can go, yeah, Stormzy, wasn't that Glastonbury show great? They'll at least think, well, at least this bloke's heard of him.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of at that level.
Right. Yeah, that makes total sense. But you also, when I asked you, you said something very interesting about some things having cultural cachet. That I think the example you gave was, it's not so much knowing about art. Probably wouldn't talk about art at the table. You wouldn't be like, oh, I've just seen a beautiful Turner exhibition. I'm using very obvious artists rather than obscure and interesting ones. Although I love Turner, hashtag love Turner. But you'd mentioned having bought art. You might talk about art that you'd purchased.
Yes, no, I think, and now we kind of, to go back to this kind of, you know, offensive versus defensive divide, I mean, clearly, and this is now, you know, at a higher level, and when I say higher, I mean higher financially, rather than more than the other sense. I mean, for example, I took my mother to, or my mother and I went to the V&A briefly on Friday, and I pointed out, as I often increasingly obsessed with, is there is obviously a Sackler wing, you know, the Sackler mm-hmm. family, of course, of OxyContin, eternal shame.
Yeah.
And of course, the Sacklers are all over the place. They're a very extreme example. But I have come across some people who have their, in my career, who have their names on parts of the V&A. Not the Sacklers, I rushed away.
Everyone rushing away from being associated with OxyContin. Yep, fair.
But I mentioned it as in that obviously is very high prestige. You know, Michael Hinsey of Goldman and CQS, whose name's all over the V&A, that's, you know, he's a very rich and successful man. And you know that for a number of reasons, but partly because his name and his wife's name are on the V&A, and that's why people do that stuff. Similarly, you know, people who sponsor things, you know, there are things like, particularly London-based things in this country, things like Covent Garden, which clearly have kind of very enormous, they have cultural cachet, which moves over into social cachet.
You're so high cultural cachet that you haven't fully explained where you mean for our listeners who aren't. Covent Garden, darling.
Covent Garden, the Royal Opera, for example. Whereas, for example, the Royal Shakespeare Company, closer to my own heart for geographical and other reasons, has less. And it probably has less because it's in Stratford-on-Avon. And also, opera is just a very expensive, heavily subsidised art form, which does, I mean, I suppose what I'm just stating kind of as a, you know, acknowledged, opera has more cultural cachet, particularly if it's, for example, at, you know, the Royal Opera at Covent Garden, and then for being associated with it as a sponsor or a donor or being named as someone that goes
If we're thinking about empowering our comprehensive students in London to move in the highest circles, it's not so much knowing about opera as being able to pour millions of pounds into the opera that will buy them entry into that social circle.
We do, but that's I've maybe taken a slight wrong direction because that's such a big leap. But having thought about it because you prompted me, I do think a comprehensive school student, for example, you do want to know what Covent Garden is. You do want to know what the proms are. You don't necessarily need to love it, but then if someone asks, you know, do you want to go? Would you like to go? Or have you been? You probably don't want to sound like you've never heard of it. If you see what I mean, and I think that's probably enough. To be honest, I don't want to draw silly equivalences. Probably a little bit, I don't know. I don't know very much about tennis, you know, but I've heard of Djokovic. I'm aware that he's a big if someone wants to talk about American tennis, I could hold a conversation for enough. I don't need to demonstrate some deep love of the game, but I need to know enough to be able to carry a conversation. And I think I would apply that same thing to high culture, if you see what I mean. I don't think it's unfair that if someone leaves school, you don't want to be the person that says, oh, I hate Shakespeare or what's up, or, you know, that would definitely be wrong. You don't need to go much better than that, you know. but I think it probably would be embarrassing, stroke something of a social disqualifier, to be kind of you know, to show it. There are things that no one wants to sound ignorant about, and that would include, you know, the kind of things we're talking about,
right?
And Dickens, whatever.
And knowing enough to know what you should fake, I think, right?
I think sadly that's probably true. Well, I mean, I'd say sadly, the same way that I would fake it if I was talking about shooting or tennis or something.
Or you know, golf.
Golf, or the endless subjects about which I know practically nothing. I think that's fair.
All right. Fascinating. Thank you so much. Oh, one random question. Do people talk more about football or rugby? Is there a social class hierarchy to the sports you're talking about?
There certainly is. And by the way, I'm aware, for especially if anyone's listening in from Wales or the West Country, and they'll be outraged at someone from Southern England saying that rugby is only for private school kids, because I know that's not universally true. But in amongst people who with whom I have spent time, rugby is definitely socially superior sport to football. Though football has, of course, you know, for those people like me who are interested in it, I mean, I do think the whole business of Nick Hornby, Fever Pitch, Italian 1990, and the middle class colonization of football is an interesting subject.
We were at college when that happened, the whole new lad movement, where suddenly everyone was pretending to be desperately authentically into football.
But I mean, it is the case. There is a social season which would include, you know, it sounds so, you know, whatever, late 19th, early 20th century, but it's true. The Chelsea Flower Show, or the Henley Regatta, or indeed rugby, or some rugby internationals, you know, these do have a greater cultural cachet than, for example, being a season ticket holder at Arsenal, you know, which, for instance. But I mean, but having a season ticket at Arsenal is socially respectable now in a way I suspect it probably wasn't in the 70s and 80s. But there definitely is a tiering, to answer your question. I think in the same way that, you know, game shooting, perhaps for no other reason than it's so bloody expensive, has got more cultural cachet than golf does. I mean, that's, you know, that it's not harder, by the way. It's much easier to do, but that's not the point. There definitely is a tiering. It would be my brief answer to your question.
Is there not part of you, I mean, like, after conversations like this, my increasing urge is to sort of revolution now and burn it all down. Does that ever occur to you?
Well, I mean, but everyone wants their own revolution. The revolution where everyone ends up being in love with 19th century literature, I'm definitely up for. You know,
the most unlikely revolution of all.
The most kind of bourgeois, you know, university educated revolution ever. I'm up for that one. Which probably disqualifies me from any real revolution.
All right, I will let you go. Thank you very, very much for that. It was gloriously fun, and I will call you soon so that we can discuss more how it is to have a small child when you are our advanced age. So, okay, thank you, Ali. All right, let's just, while Ali's hanging up there, I'm going to bring you a message from another one of our sponsors. So one of the sponsors of this show is teacherslovestationery.club. If you love stationery, and many teachers do, then you should check out Teachers Love Stationery. Sign up and you get a box of carefully selected stationery delivered through the post each month. Items could include pens, pencils, stickers, pins, erasers, highlighters, and many more besides. These will change month to month and will be based around a monthly theme. TLS are always on the hunt for new and exciting items to surprise you with. All the items that you will receive are useful for teachers and won't just sit at the bottom of a drawer. To find out more, visit www.teacherslovestationery.club. That's again, www.teacherslovestationery.club. Right, Ali's having problems disconnecting. Just unplug it all, mate. Hang up. Click everything, throw it in the sea. Otherwise, we'll be listening to you while you go about the rest of your morning. Right. Thank you. Now, that was a slightly more interesting and sophisticated discussion than I imagined. I really just thought he was going to tell me, we talk about, I don't know, rugby and what's happening in the weather. But yeah, that in general, though, that's the very crass version of the argument for cultural capital, is that it's an instrumental set of factoids that sort of enable you to shake hands and eat dinner with the upper classes without dropping a Stormzy reference or the wrong fork, right? But as Ali pointed out there, wide general knowledge and interest in each other and interest in what other people are interested in sort of serves that purpose. I'm going to have to think about some of the things he said there. But what I want to talk to you about for the rest of the day is the correlated argument. And that is that if some culture is good and helpful, some must be bad and wrong. Ali touched on there about the way football was in the 80s and early 90s. Rugby was what the upper middle classes consumed, certainly in Southeast England, while football was distinctly working class, sneered at, not something that happened until the mid-90s when we had a huge kind of cultural revolution built around that. So not just that some things are weak cultural source, but that they're active toxins, sort of doing down the aspirations and dreams of our youth, leading them into lives of crime and low expectations. And that is what we call a moral panic, It's a term coined in the 60s, has become increasingly in vogue. The sort of short version, copy and pasted from a dictionary, is that a moral panic is a mass movement based on the false or exaggerated perception that some cultural behavior or group of people is dangerously deviant and poses a threat to society's values and interests. It's just saying hi to Tom Rogers here, who has a free period on a week one Mondays. I have a whole free day on a Monday, which, yeah, but glad to have you here, Tom. So I was born in the 70s, and here are some things that were banned, restricted, or otherwise panicked about in my teenage years due to their pernicious and corrupting potential impact on the youth. Some of these were banned outright. Some of them, there was just a lot of cultural anxiety over. Some of them, there were congressional hearings in the United States. Let's travel back through and down memory lane. So, an arbitrary selection of grisly-sounding horror films known as video nasties to stop the youth from doing murders. We had to ban them. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, to stop the youth from running wild with nunchucks. They were changed to Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles in the United Kingdom. An episode of Degrassi Junior High was banned to stop the youth from being lesbians. Relax by Frankie Goes to Hollywood was banned from the airwaves to presumably stop the youth from having sex. It didn't work, not so much touching on the sex thing there as the fact that literally everyone in the country wore a Frankie Says Relax t-shirt for at least 6 months. Ozzy Osbourne records, lots of anxiety around them to stop the youth from playing them backwards and hearing satanic messages. Prince records, specifically Darling Nikki, to stop the youth from playing them forwards and hearing about female masturbation. Hunting High and Low by A-ha, poor old A-ha, not even their best song, along with 67 other songs at the time, were removed from radio play on the BBC to stop the youth from drawing musical parallels between the lyrical content and the Gulf War. Yeah. Music with repetitive beats was banned round about the time that that football was re-entering the world of middle-class men who write novels about Nick Hornby, basically. Music with repetitive beats was criminalised by the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act of 1994. To stop the youth from dancing. An episode of Star Trek The Next Generation was banned for at least a decade to stop the youth from hearing about the science fictional possibility of a united Ireland, and many others beside. But there have been, as the point of my list is there, a huge variety of moral panic and anxiety surrounding the idea that if young people listen to certain things or watch certain things, it will destroy their behavior, break their brains, introduce great moral corruption that will bring down the nation. We have a lot of that discussion goes on edgy Twitter and in the papers of both the broadsheets and tabloids all the time. Some music is bad, particularly rap is always singled out as being bad. Drill obviously is criminalized in many instances. But so I thought what we do is look back at an 18th century panic. Now, if we go to the 20th century, we're all quite familiar with those. That list I read there of things that were banned, that probably happened at least in most of your lifetimes. You will know, if you're an interested general reader, about moral panic surrounding comic books in the 1950s in the United States, which meant that they had to go through essentially an official censor to approve their dangerous content. You'll know about anxiety surrounding visual media like films and television. And so therefore, I'd like to take us to what happened when the novel became popular and literacy began to increase. Because what happened then was that the very type of text that we now say children should be engaging with, that is the one they should be doing instead of doing a Stormzy or a Drill or a Cardi B, the novel was considered deeply, terrifyingly dangerous. So here's a nice summary from History Today that I'll just read you out first. When cultural commentators lament the decline of the habit of reading books, it's difficult to imagine that back in the 18th century, many prominent voices were concerned about the threat posed by people reading too much. A dangerous disease appeared to afflict the young, which some diagnosed as reading addiction and others as reading rage, reading fever, reading mania, or reading lust. Throughout Europe, reports circulated about the outbreak of what was described as an epidemic of reading. The behaviours associated with this supposedly insidious contagion were sensation-seeking, moral dissolution, and promiscuous behaviour. Even acts of self-destruction were associated with this new craze for the reading of novels. There was that's a reference to the Goethe novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther, which allegedly led to an uncontrollable spate of suicides due to nascent romanticism across Europe. Of course, novels, there were moral panics surrounding art forms and the consumption of them by young people before there were novels. Notably, 1698, a man called Jeremy Collier changed the course of English drama by bringing out his exciting work, thrillingly entitled A Short View of the Immorality and Profaneness of the English Stage, in 1698. So in his introduction, he says, he lays out his raison d'etre here. Being convinced that nothing has gone farther in debauching the age than the stage poets and playhouse, I thought I could not employ my time better than in writing against them. And then he goes on to attack the plays in production one after another, including Hamlet and an enormous number of Shakespeare. The representation of Ophelia was considered deeply disgusting by people writing like Collier and people in his time. He calls them nurseries of vice, the corruptors of youth, and the grievance of the country where they are suffered. Being convinced that nothing has gone farther in debauching the age, he must destroy these corruptors of youth, the grievance of the country, and the nurseries of vice. And he did. Plays got really boring after that. Restoration drama wasn't particularly thrilling. So then we toddle along. We've got slightly more regularized plays. There's lots of things to be morally panicky about. But the novel, the explosion of the novel in the second half of the 18th century, really kicks off people's anxiety. And very, very rapidly, what starts happening is that every single novel has to include within it a Jeremiad about novels, or a very careful positioning where you say, like, I've written a novel, but it's not one of those novels. Or I've written a novel and the main character is a girl who reads novels, and that's driven her to a life of terrible disillusion, which is why my novel is different, because it's got a good moral about not reading novels in a novel about reading novels. If that sounds confusing, let's see some of the torturous justification going on. This one, Family Pictures, a novel by Susanna Gunning, 1764. So long as we admire paintings merely on account of the masterly strokes, we find in them authors for their wit and amusement for only being fashionable, we shall continue in danger of rendering obscenity familiar to us by obscene portraitures, of corrupting our morals by profane writers, and spending our time unworthily by implicitly following the example of this few. So it's not just that novels aren't as good for you as the Bible or other improving literature. They are obscene. They are destructive. They will drive your young people to lives of terrible, terrible sexual hedonism. Fordyce's Sermons to Young Women in 1766. If you are a person who's a fan of writing of the long 18th century, you will recognize that from Pride and Prejudice, when the terrible, terrible Reverend Collins comes to propose to one or other of the Bennet sisters, settles upon Elizabeth, and then chooses to entertain all the girls by reading them from Fordyce's sermons until Lydia, of whom I am secretly fond, essentially yawns, slides off her chair and refuses to listen, but everybody else has to sit there in paralyzed politeness. Here's what Fordyce says in his sermons to young women in 1766. And again, what's fascinating to me is that the novels are always reflecting on novels in the period. Novels are always aware, novelists are always aware that they are not seen, that they're sloping embarrassedly into the house to say, I promise I won't make your daughter run off with the stable hand, but just in case, let's have a look. So this is the Fordyce on novels. We consider the general run of novels as utterly unfit for you. Instruction, they convey none. They paint scenes of pleasure and passion altogether improper for you to behold, even with the mind's eye. Their descriptions are often loose and luscious in a high degree. Their representations of love between the sexes are almost universally overstrained. All is dotage or despair, all else ranting swelled into burlesque. In short, the majority of their lovers are either mere lunatics or mock heroes. a sweet sensibility, a charming tenderness, a delightful anguish, exalted generosity, heroic worth, and refinement of thought. How seldom are these best ingredients of virtuous love mixed with any judgment or care in the composition of their principal characters? If you're noticing that these are largely surrounding an anxiety about young women, you have put your finger on it, dear listener, because enormously we're talking about the explosion of literacy among women, as we'll see people talking about, and therefore enormous anxiety about what they're reading. A direct relationship between opening the pages and opening their legs. Vicesimus Knox, Essays, Moral and Literary in 1788. Here he's telling us, he started off with the basis that, of course, you don't want your young people, male or female, to read novels. What could be more foolish? What could be more disgusting to the thought than that you'd let them read novels? So instead, what will they eat? If, however, novels to be prohibited, in what, it will be asked, can the young mind employ itself during the hours of necessary leisure? And to this, it may be answered that when the sweetened poison is removed, plain and wholesome food will always be relished. The growing mind will crave nourishment and will gladly seek it in true histories written in a pleasing and easy style on purpose for its use. If we get rid of novels, lads, the kids will read history books. So that's exciting. More on the same theme, familiar essays on interesting subjects. This person is describing their ideal partner. So that's a common thing. Like, yes, random man in a book in the middle of the 18th century. I really do care about what you're looking for in a life partner, and it really will make me shape what I want from life. I, a young lady of 17 or so, sitting in my closet thinking about it. So here's, of course, he says, he's thinking about everything great about this woman, but I will not suppose her mind tainted by those books which preach up the uncontrollable influence of the passions over morality and virtue, nor vitiated, as is too often the case, by the corrupting style of the generality of novels to be found in that convenient repository, a circulating library. So the circulating library has entered the chat. If you've read Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen, published after her death, there's a wonderful description of how young women are using the circulating libraries, which are a new phenomenon in the 18th century. Suddenly you don't have to purchase the books yourselves. You can just go in and pay. They're not free. You can pay to withdraw books. You buy a subscription and then you can get any books you want. And what the kids are reading is corruption, apparently. There's a beautiful defense of the novel in Northanger Abbey, but there's also some very amused representation of the kind of trash that Mrs. Radcliffe, Mysteries of Udolpho, purely sensationalist fiction that they're reading. But that, the presence of these, you don't have to buy them, they're not as carefully gatekept. Young women can get in and roam the shelves, infecting themselves on the regular with all kinds of novels. That becomes a really insistent strain of the period, which is a bit like streaming or YouTube, but for your 18th century kind of girl. What if the kids can just listen to Drill, watch Lil Nas X and his exciting Satan sex video? I love that, by the way. That song is amazing. Or any of these, they can just get hold of them. They can be corrupted. It's destroying them. Right, we got Gentleman's Magazine 1788. It praises circulating libraries because they increase the public good. But then we have a dire warning. And let's see. The passions might have lain dormant without such assistance. Basically, the argument is that any young man or woman walking into a library has these dormant lust and terrible, terrible urges inside them to murder, to rape, to kill. They would never have come out had they not chanced upon a stray volume of Clarissa and fallen in love with Mr. Lovelace. Let's hear a little bit more about what might happen. Your son will now think of nothing else but indulgence. He will judge of every female as the fierce animals, bestia ferae, do of every animal they can conquer, viz. That they are lawful prey. And like them too, he will soon learn to be dexterous in the arts of ensnaring. He may probably tire of the common herd of the abandoned, but any innocent girl who strikes his fancy, he will be artful in wiles and stratagems to seduce. It is remarked by some acute observers of human nature that young people are easily corrupted and generally inhuman and cruel, that they are impatient, vindictive, impetuous, and frequently brutal in their manners. They have only one object to occupy their imagination, in pursuit of which they will lie, cheat, and deceive. Well, if we imagine that young men are that prone to murder, rape, and destruction of all around them, you can see why you might like to avoid giving them a novel. You really can't. But I hope you're noticing. I'm not going to draw too many explicit parallels to it, because to me it's so incredibly obvious that the language surrounding the dangers of letting young people in London listen to certain genres of music, and the language surrounding the dangers of letting young people go into a library and read books, are remarkably similar. Right, New Ladies Magazine, polite and entertaining companion for the fair sex, 1789. This one I just like because it's funny. She's this person's quite reasonable. They're like, you know, let's face it, young people aren't really running off and becoming sex workers because they've read a novel. Young men aren't all out doing rapes on the regular. But there is a problem with novels. I suspect that it has given food to the idle passion for those eternal scribblings which pass between one female friend and another and tend to no good point of education. Specifically saying here that the epistolary letter format of the 18th century has caused middle-class girls to start writing to each other all the time. Please stop writing your infernal letters. Right? And then this one I really love. I have a young lady in my eye who made her will, wrote an inscription for the plate of her coffin, and forswore all of mankind at the age of 16. She sounds like my kind of girl. She sounds like a little bit of me. Right, it's time for the news again. I'm just going to run that, and then we'll be back with what happens by the time we get to the 1790s. We're nearly there, and it's horrifying.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News with Gail Glenn. Ofsted have admitted that its inspectors were not highlighting off-rolling when it was identified in schools. Ofsted has told their inspectors that they must use the specific term off-rolling in their report if they find that it is taking place in a school. Ofsted defines off-rolling as the practice of removing a pupil from the school roll without a formal permanent exclusion, or by encouraging a parent to remove their child from the school roll where the removal is primarily in the interest of the school rather than in the interest of the pupil. Off-rolling in these circumstances is a form of gaming. In an update to inspectors, it adds, some schools have issued press releases stating that off-rolling was not found because Ofsted did not use those words. Reports which have already been issued cannot be amended. Ofsted were reported in the Times Educational Supplement to have told inspectors that reports must always use the following set phrase to refer to off-rolling. This practice constitutes off-rolling, according to Ofsted's definition. The Guardian newspaper has reported that a survey of more than 20,000 working parents has found that 96% believed that not enough was being done to support parents with the cost of childcare. One third of parents said they spent less on their rent or mortgage than they did on childcare. 100,000 parents signed a petition asking for an independent review of childcare funding and affordability. This has triggered a debate on childcare in Parliament this week. The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development has released data which puts the UK as the third highest childcare system in the world. A full-time place costs, on average, £12,376 a year. The Department for Education said parents' ability to claim 33 hours a week during term time for 3 and 4 year olds could save them up to £5,000 a year. This has been your daily education news briefing.
One of the sponsors of this show is Mal CPD. If you struggle with people pleasing and find it is a constant battle to manage different and difficult personalities, then why not challenge and empower your team through the Mal CPD Essential Coaching Skills for School Leaders course? Alternatively, gain practical skills to become a strong and compassionate leader through the Assertive Leadership and Emotionally Intelligent Leader course. All Mal CPD courses are accredited by the Institute of Leadership and Management. Find out more at www.malcpd.com. That's www.malcpd.com. Right, and we are back. We're just about to hit 1790. Why is 1790? Why does everything ramp up so hilariously in the 1790s? Well, history fans will all know that that's when all the revolutions start happening. So 1789, French Revolution, 1792, Haitian Revolution begins. There are riots, there are waves of people demanding rights to assemble, rights to form trade unions. There, Mary Wollstonecraft is publishing sort of Vindication of the Rights of Woman. Too many rights are in the air. People are getting ideas in their heads. And the only culprit for getting those ideas in their heads must be books. So the novel we have consistently is associated with hedonistic, loose morals, but also dangerously radical ideas. That starts being the argument in the 1790s. And when we're not worrying about that, the idea that the novel is both everywhere and also fundamentally trash, so much trash, is built into every review, even a good review. So this one is from the Monthly Review. It's of Helen Maria Williams' novel, Julia. And it's talking about the emergence of novels, how many of them there are. Hence, novels spring into existence like insects on the bank of the Nile. And if we may be indulged in another comparison, cover the shelves of our circulating libraries as locusts crowd the fields of Asia. Their great and growing number is a serious evil, for in general, they exhibit delusive views of human life. And while they amuse, frequently poison the mind. New paragraph. The work now before us is an exception to this censure. Essentially, it's like putting on a hazmat suit and handing over a novel with a pair of tongs. Yeah, all the rest of them are destroying us like a vaguely orientalist image of locusts swarming through the nation, destroying our youth, bringing down our women in their prime. But this one may be okay. We'll see. Let's see. With pleasure, we take this opportunity of announcing Miss Williams's Julia, since it not only possesses no pernicious tendency, but conveys a very useful moral. No pernicious tendency is first there. The idea that reading is pernicious is definitely the default. Then we have Edinburgh Fugitive Pieces by William Creech, 1791, another in the genre of a man tells you what he'd like in a girl that he wants to marry, even though no one asked him at all whatsoever. I would wish her to be so well informed as to make a conversable companion, but she must not have been an indiscriminate reader. Reading a lot is bad, especially at circulating libraries, as I would not have her mind either corrupted or giddy with extravagant views of life. Then we have, I mentioned that novels have to build in the idea that novels are bad throughout. That's absolutely a feature of the 1790s novel. This one's Robert Bage, Man As He Is, 1792. Talking specifically about novels and female readers. Except the wives and daughters of country labourers, all women read now, or seem to read, whether fairy tales or novels be the mental food most meet for a moiety of our reading ladies, I do not determine, but since, as I presume by the demand, their choice falls upon the latter, novels, I remember what the great King of Prussia said upon a sort of similar occasion. If my loving subjects choose to be damned, I give them my permission. So if my pretty country women will read nonsense, I am not a man to bar them so reasonable a liberty. So, pretty country women filling their heads. Now, here is where we really start getting fascinating, which 1797, the terror has been and gone, but the fear that there will be blood and revolution in the streets in both Britain and Europe has fully taken hold in some of our more easily alarmed commentary class. And this one is quite a famous book that I've struggled through on at least one occasion, called, long title, you ready? Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe Carried On in the Secret Meetings of Freemasons, Illuminati, and Reading Societies. People are reading books. The Illuminati are coming. This is how they're doing it. This is John Robison, 1797. Went through a million editions. This is sort of, he's kind of responsible for popularizing the drifting idea that the evil Illuminati are trying to undermine our country, kill our young people's morals, bring us all down with, well, if we did it now, we'd say it was critical race theory and cultural Marxism, or whatever everyone's hysterically alarmed about today in America. So this is how they did it. This is how the evil Freemasons, Illuminati, and Reading Societies are bringing down Europe. They hired an army of writers. They industriously pushed their writings into every house and every cottage. Those writings were equally calculated for inflaming the sensual appetites of men and for perverting their judgments. They endeavoured to get command of the schools, particularly those for the lower classes, and they erected and managed a prodigious number of circulating libraries and reading societies. You'll notice that rich middle class, upper class men in the 18th century can be presumed to read novels without any harm. The people who keep coming up again and again as being troublesome, yes, young men of any class, but most especially young women and the lower classes. The emergence of widely spread reading material and the emergence of media consumption and the emergence of mass literacy is a source of extreme anxiety. Shout out in this episode, as I do in every episode, to Matthew Arnold's Culture and Anarchy, which we all, for reasons that entirely escape me, use quite regularly on the front of our knowledge-rich booklets at school, the best that has been thought and said. His entire project is to manage this dangerous anarchy by giving people Brussels sprouts literature and art to read. Because if the poor can read, if women can read, then they're going to kill us all, people. It's definitely going to happen when they're not. If they can be distracted, rather, from running off and having sex with each other. So that's Mr. Robison. Let's find out what's happening if we pop over the Atlantic. Big Anglophone Atlantic print culture circulating everywhere. If someone's saying it in Andover, then they're also saying it in Hampshire. So an address to the students at Phillips Academy in Andover, Jedediah Morse, 1799. Are the Americans any more reasonable about novels? Let's find out. Don't just read. Basically, this is don't walk into a library and start reading. For God's sake, make sure you don't do that, because it will prompt you to read those books that have been poured into our country by the thousands and circulated with much art and industry among young people, and which are replete with concealed but deadly poison to your principles and morals. Concerned as we feel for your welfare, we would affectionately urge you individually to solicit some faithful, well-principled and experienced friend to prescribe for you your course of reading. Not only, so we've got Robison saying that the Illuminati and evil secret masters of Europe are corrupting the nations through circulating libraries and reading societies. Now we have old Jedediah telling us that it's happening the other way. They're all coming from England and infecting America, just like, you know, cultural Marxism. It's exactly the same argument, people. It's always exactly the same argument. then, I quite like this. We have Coleridge not being cool. I have to say, low points to Coleridge here in 1817, talking about what books used to be like back in the day. Back in the day when there were fewer books, when only some people wrote the books, when only some people read the books, when they weren't all just so many pages and so many indiscriminate readers, so many pesky literate poor people and annoying women. In times of old, books were as religious oracles. As literature advanced, they next became venerable preceptors. They then descended to the rank of instructive friends. And as their numbers increased, they sank still lower to that of entertaining companions. And at present, they seem degraded into culprits to hold up their hands at the bar of every self-elected, let not the less peremptory judge who chooses to write from humour or interest, from enmity or arrogance, and to abide the decision of him that reads in malice or him that reads after dinner. Reading after dinner, shocking to old Samuel. Back in the day, music was good. Now there's too much music. It's the wrong music. Anybody's making music. Music will corrupt you. Books will corrupt you. Reading Diary of a Wimpy Kid might break you. Your children will never become intelligent. Saw someone on Twitter actually say they'd remove them forcibly from the school library so children wouldn't read them anymore because it was stunting their brains. Perhaps it was corrupting their morals. Who knows? Maybe they got the cheese touch from it. Sanditon, rather beautiful. Jane Austen, always conscious of the fact that she's writing novels and incorporating theories about novels into her novels about novels. Lovely self-referential work. This is her unfinished novel, Sanditon, 1817. Gorgeous fragment of a novel. Totally recommend reading it. But there's this character in it, Sir Edward. His character has been formed by injudicious novel reading, which has trained him to be a seducer. But this is a satirical representation. So here's how she puts it. The truth was that Sir Edward, whom circumstances had confined very much to one spot, had read more sentimental novels than agreed with him. His fancy had been early caught by all the impassioned and most exceptionable parts of Richardson's, and such authors as had since appeared to tread in Richardson's steps, so far as man's determined of pursuit in defiance of every opposition of feeling and convenience was concerned, had since occupied the greater part of his literary hours and formed his character. He's a hilarious character. He's always trying to set up complex seduction schemes. Waha, my pretty, I have you. And you know, all the characters are just a bit confused about what he's doing. But I feel like that one's a parody of what novels are supposed to do with you rather than actually a serious danger of what novels will happen. And then as we move to the end here today, let's touch upon poetry in the 1820s. So these are all moral panics that happened before Victoria came to the throne. This one's the Brighton Magazine, 1822, and now poetry. In an age when the press is teeming with the writings of the infidel school, when the brilliant garb of poetry serves as a cloak to sentiments of the most corrupt immorality and daring impiety, when language in its most seducing form steals from us, or at least deadens the horror we should entertain in perusing the writings of blasphemers and adulterers. It's really nice. This was the preamble to come across quite a nice poem by quite a nice person. So, again, there we have the idea that construction, musical construction, melodic charm, prosodic charm, poetic charm, all of that is a sneaky delivery device for the injection of the destruction of life as we know it, bringing down Britain's morals, destroying our nation from within, all because these people keep choosing what to listen to and read and recite to each other. And there's a great book that I came across last night, written by Cato. So that's just the name people take on when they're doing pamphlets. This person's not really called Cato. Cato to Lord Byron on the immorality of his writings. Like, cheers, mate. I'm sure Byron would have read this, wouldn't he? And been hilariously amused by it. But so in the introduction, he's explaining to Byron why it is he's chosen to write a sententious pamphlet about why Byron's bad for all of us. It is the immorality of your writings that will constitute with me the chief theme of investigation. It is the deformity that attaches to you as a Christian and a man. So, blurring of the personal character and criminal records and dangerous, madly, badly dangerous sexuality of authors, the idea that that's hidden or somehow transmissible and contagious through their written work, all of those things, consistent from 1750 to 1820 to 2021 in a discussion of Cardi B. I love that song, by the way, WAP. I think it's fabulous. I think our young people would do well to listen to more of it. This one, Imperial Magazine, we're coming up to Victoria when we can move on to a new level of moral panic because, fascinatingly, fact fans, paper gets much cheaper. And as soon as we can start mass printing on wood pulp, hence the phrase pulp fiction, then we can have a whole new level of unimaginable moral panic about what the poor are reading, especially now we've foolishly allowed them to learn to read even more so than we had before. 1870 Education Act, my God, think of all the cowboy stories they will read and then go hold up stagecoaches across the nation. So, Imperial Magazine, 1830, talking about the spread of literacy. Alas, what do these multitudes of human beings acquire by this voluminous reading? Acquire? What do they wish to acquire? Nothing. What can be their object in a course of reading? To slaughter an hour, to kill time. The amusement the pursuit affords is their object, viz. To kindle up pleasing sensations in incessant variety amidst their bosoms, which, like the delirium of the drunkard, leads the man out of himself and for the moment fills the aching void which the total vacuity of such minds labour under, and with which they are as seriously afflicted as a patient labouring under a confirmed chronic distemper. The kids, the women, the poor aren't intelligent enough to have structures in their brain that will temper their reading. Instead, it will all just be poured in and they will turn into terrible criminal deviants. Yale Literary Magazine, 1838. I'll just finish us off with that one. The amount of immoral poetry in the English language now extant is truly appalling. The floodgates have been opened and few can stem the torrent of corruption. And that is why, of course, we live in the world we do now in 2021, because we've all been drowned in the floodgate of filthy, filthy immoral poetry. True story. All right. Thank you for listening, everyone. That is my time for today. I hope you enjoyed listening to Ali. Thank you again, Ali, for your really quite sophisticated thoughts there on habits, trivia, and how we pass amongst each other in social situations. And I will be back next week for no doubt more literary ramblings. Have a good day. Wrong one. Trying again.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.